I was telling Scott before the service that it always feels like I'm coming home when I get to come speak at the Orchard. I just feel like this is family to me. And I also tell him, like, there's some churches that I go to and I speak at, and they're fine, and they're nice people and stuff, but I don't really want to get to know them very well. And I'm ready to go home. This is different. This is like a whole different experience for me. I just feel relaxed and at home, and I want to know your stories because your stories are important. And I think we're on the same page in this when we think about grace and how we interact with people and the posture that we have every day with hurting, broken people, or even people that are our friends or people who are struggling, or as we engage the prodigal, or as we even look at our own lives and what God is doing there, we need grace. And I love you guys, and I love being here, and I mean that. I'm not a guy who says stuff like that just because that's what you're supposed to say when you're a speaker and all that. I think that's crap, the people that lie from the stage and don't mean things. I mean that. So I am Mike Foster. I lead a movement called People a Second Chance. Movement's kind of probably more important than it really is. It's just really a community of people who want to unleash radical grace every day, in every moment, for everyone. That's our mission. It's very simple. We do two basic things. Number one, we gather community, and we've got over 30,000 people who said, I want to live for grace, and I'm gonna extend grace to others and to myself. We equip them and give them things to talk about grace and share grace with their family and friends and at their workplaces. And then the second thing that we do that's super important and really why I signed up for all of this is we help people one-on-one in the midst of their comeback story, or people who are falling. We want to be their parachute. People in the midst of their comeback story, we want to be their rocket. I say this sometimes, and this bothers my wife when I describe it this way, what we do, but it's sort of like if Tony Robbins, you know, an inspirational guy, hope-giving guy, he's like great cheerleader, and Mother Teresa were to hook up at a bar one night and sort of have this illegitimate child. People of Second Chance would be that child. That's kind of what we want to just encourage and instill hope and life and joy into people who are going through the valley, but we also want to just love on people and help the hurting and the broken. The hurting are our heroes. They really are. And we give them a place to heal and recharge. We have sort of five... This is really funny, because Scott...
That's really funny.
We were joking about this earlier, about those music stands that just kind of continually sink down. This one has clearly... It's been decapitated here. This is funny. Okay. Maybe we'll layer this. I'll just put it here. I hope nobody needed that, but... So we have these five life marks, character traits of people of Second Chance. One is empathy, just the ability to be present with people and to love people, to have compassion and listen, which is just a huge need in our society. Purpose, where we have been rescued to become a rescuer. We have a purpose in life. Hope, where we are not sort of these down, sad, sorrowful people. We actually believe that Jesus has an amazing plan for our lives. We claim Jeremiah 29:11. Tenacity. We have to live with tenacity because life is hard. When you're walking through that valley, you don't want to quit. You got to keep going. So we tell people, do not stop. Every Monday morning, we send out this thing called No Quit Monday. Because when you get there on Monday, it's like this... Life is kind of sucky. You had this great weekend, now you're back at work, or all those emails come in, and you're like, gosh, don't quit. Tenacity. And then the final piece, and this is what I want to talk about tonight, is the mark of courage. The courage to forgive. The courage to hug our haters. The courage to love our enemies. Why? Not just because the Bible tells us to, but we love our enemies because it totally freaks them out, right? I mean, that's why we do it. But it takes courage to forgive, to let go, to surrender, to follow and pursue our dreams. And if you have your pen and a piece of paper, this is what I want you to remember tonight. This simple statement, like, you forget everything I say after this point, it's fine. But it's this is the main point of tonight. And it's simply this: life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage. Let me say that again. Life shrinks, it gets small, contracts, or it expands, gets big and adventurous and full and joyful. But that all is in proportion to one's courage. And this is maybe to add this little piece to that statement. Jesus wants us to live courageously. Courageous lives for him. And here's the problem that I see so often in our churches is that we really don't live courageously. We actually live with fear and anxiety. And instead of stepping forward into growth, we step back into safety. And a lot of us, we probably think we're more courageous than we are. We probably think that we're laying more on the line than we really are. We are embracing risk. And yet I think it's probably like those, if we were honest, we'd see those roller coaster pictures that they take of you at the top of the hill. You know, those little photos, like pictures like this. This is really what our lives look like. Right? Like, Jesus is taking us on this ride, and this is really kind of how we're responding. Our pictures like this. Check this out, yeah. Doesn't that guy look like Alec Baldwin? It looks like he'd be a Baldwin, right? And then, of course, this. Oh, my. See, I'll bet you Chris C. did not show a vomit picture when he came, But this is like we're trying to be brave and courageous, and we're on our lives, and yet this is what it's looking like. We're scaredy cats. Well, I found this. You can get that off the screen. That's you're never inviting me back here, Scott, are you? I'm never coming back. So, anyways, I found this video. I love this video. It's a video of a dad and his daughter at Dollywood. And, yeah, Dollywood. Who goes to Dollywood? I guess Dollywood's, and they're on this roller coaster, and it's called the Barnstormer. And I want you to watch this video. We're going to watch it together. And this is just classic looking into the face of fear. You got that? Here we go. Dad and his daughter. He's good. She's pretty excited. He is not having fun there. And look at her smile. She's having a great time. Hands up. Now watch. Moment of bravery. Moment of bravery. Boom. Right there. Oh. Okay, I love that. But now watch. This is where he wins Father of the Year award. Check this out. Watch this. They're going to do it again. A little moral support there. Now he's done it once, so he's probably got it all. He's gonna be good this time. All right. Well, you know how the rest of it goes. That's great. I just love that because I think that's us. I think that's how we live our lives. We're like, oh my gosh. And this is the ride that Jesus wants to take us on. It's an adventure, and it's got ups and it has downs. But we have to have courage. We have to trust. We have to put our trust in Jesus and have faith in him that he's got it all. He's our rock, our refuge, our fortress, our shield. He's all of that. And are we living that way? Do we believe that truth? I think there's this horrible, horrible thing going on in the church, and not in this church, but in churches across America. We teach our people to kind of live safely. Don't step out. Don't go into those dark places. And I say this all the time, don't blame the dark for being dark. Blame the light for not shining on the dark. It's like we need to have courage. We need to be brave. You know, it's like we sort of send out messages like this to our young men. Young men, listen. Chick-fil-A needs you. The chicken wars are on, and we send them into battle and to fight for nuggets and waffle fries. Right? To be strong for our sweet tea. Or how about this? We our young women, we say, listen, ladies, we want you to go out there and have terrifying, scary, quiet times. Right? I mean, these are the messages that we're putting out there. It's like Jesus going, come on, guys. Let's go. There's a hurting world out there. There are broken people. We got to get out of our Christian comfort zone. We got to step out into growth instead of stepping back into safety. I think this is very true, that most people don't aim too high and miss it. They aim too low and they hit it. That's the problem, right? But here's what the Bible says. Deuteronomy 31:6 says, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or terrified because of them. For the Lord your God goes with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. That's his promise. Or Ephesians 6:10 says, finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. Because just as Jesus wants you to live a big, courageous life for him, Satan, the enemy, wants you to live a very small and safe life. He's like, no. Listen, let's just go to church. Let's have our small groups. Let's just kind of do the routine. We'll wait for heaven, and it's all going to be great. He's perfect. The enemy is perfectly fine with you doing that. He's not okay with you acting courageous and brave and stepping out and saying, we're going to change this. We're going to do something about this. He's not okay with you loving your enemies and forgiving that family member and reconciling and having restoration. He's not okay with that. He doesn't want you to make, you know, any sort of ruckus at work because of your faith. He wants you to just kind of fit right in. Courage. You know, the meaning of the word courage, it has that word core. And the history of that word is that the core is the heart. And Jesus wants to get a hold of our heart and draw us into dangerous places to do dangerous things. If you have your Bibles, we're going to look at Ruth. And Ruth is an amazing story. And I would summarize Ruth's kind of this passage that we're going to read like this. This is someone who has 20 seconds of insane courage. How many of you have seen that movie, We Bought a Zoo, with Matt Damon? It's a great movie. Definitely check it out. But in it, there's a scene where Matt's character is sitting on the ground, and he's talking with his son, and he goes, you know, sometimes all it takes is 20 seconds of insane courage. 20 seconds of embarrassing bravery, and something great will come of it. So we look at this passage of Ruth and hear her story. That's exactly what's happening here. So we're going to look at Ruth chapter 3, and we're going to start in verse 7. And so let me give you a little background here. So there's Ruth and Naomi, and they're both widows. And Naomi is Ruth's mother-in-law, and she's older than Ruth. And Ruth is kind of taking care of her and supporting her. And they're both widows, and they're Moabites. They're from a land, a region called Moab. And they now travel to Bethlehem looking for work. So they're foreigners. And even being a Moabite is not a very good thing in this society, because Moabites, their history or their lineage goes way back to Lot, where Lot has sex with his daughter, and the offspring of that relationship starts the lineage of the Moabites. So they kind of, it's not a great history, okay? And not only that, a widow, I know we think about widows today and we're like, oh, you're a widow, but it's kind of a normal thing, and they're equals, and there's nothing, I mean, that happens. Death happens. But in this society, in this day and age, widows are kind of the most vulnerable people, being taken advantage of in every possible way you can be taken advantage of. So Ruth and Naomi, they're widows, they're Moabites, they're foreigners who have come to Bethlehem to look for work. And Ruth is now working in the fields of a man named Boaz. And Boaz is a man of character and integrity. And Ruth is working for him. And Ruth and Naomi devise a plan where Ruth is going to have to demonstrate 20 seconds of insane courage. And this 20 seconds is going to change history, the course of history, and change her life forever. So here we do. Here we go, picking up in verse 7. After Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he lay down at the far end of the pile of grain and went to sleep. Then Ruth came quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. So Boaz has had some drink and some eats, and he's now going, and he's laying down on his grain. And the reason he's doing that is because he's protecting his crop and his grain, so he sleeps there on the grain. And Ruth quietly comes in, and she wants to get together with him. Now, this is not some sort of, you know, boom chicka wah wah moment here. This is not nothing sexual happening here. We don't have, you know, smooth jazz on the radio or, you know, Marvin Gaye, you know, nothing like that. You know, no candles. It's just like, this is the time that she's going to get with him. She's going to connect with him, and she's going to talk to him, because she's just a lowly servant working in his fields. And so she's going now to try and have a conversation. So picking up in verse 8, around midnight, Boaz suddenly woke up and turned over. He was surprised to find a woman lying at his feet. Okay, that could be an understatement. Verse 9, he says, "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant, Ruth," she replied. "Spread the corner of your covering over me, for you are my family redeemer." So what is she saying here? She makes this request to Boaz. Basically, what she's saying to Boaz is, "Will you marry me?" This phrase, "spread the corner of your covering over me, for you are my family redeemer." It's a proposal for marriage. So let me kind of boil this down into kind of the most simplest terms of what's happening here. This is the rose ceremony of the bachelorette, okay? Yes. So this is Emily, okay? And Jeff, and you watch that show, don't you, Scott? I know you do. How do you know Emily and Jeff, Scott? Okay, all right. So this is what's going on here. Now, just think about this. This is a courageous act on Ruth's behalf, because, you know, we watch The Bachelorette, and that's a great show. And even today, in today's times, it's a little odd for a woman to ask a man to marry her, right? And we see, you know, Emily do that, but that's not normal. Guys usually ask girls to marry them. And so think about back in this time, how odd this might be. It's pretty different. It's different. It's she's taking a risk. She could be rejected here. She's kind of laying it all out on the line. She knows who she is. But she gets the words out and she says, "Will, Boaz, will you marry me?" How does Boaz react? Verse 10, "The Lord bless you, my daughter," Boaz exclaimed. "You are showering even more family loyalty now than you did before. For you have not gone after a younger man, whether rich or poor." So he's flattered. It's like, this is cool. Wow. I mean, you could have gone after a younger man, and here you are coming after me. And it's like, I'm kind of impressed. Verse 11, "Now don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary, for everyone in town knows you are a virtuous woman." So later on in the chapter and later on in the story, we find out that Ruth and Boaz do marry, and they produce an offspring. They have a son, and this offspring then puts Ruth in the lineage of King David, which then leads to the lineage of Jesus Christ himself. Do you know that Ruth is one of the only four women that is mentioned in Jesus' lineage? Why? 20 seconds of insane courage, of her getting the words out, believing that God had a great plan for a widow Moabite. She stepped out in faith and said, "God, you need to do something big here. I need you." She had courage. She didn't resign herself to just being a servant in Boaz's field. She went to him in sort of odd circumstances, you know, late at night, lays at his feet, and something big happened. I mean, the other thing, I mean, think about it. Do any of you have a book in the Bible about your story? I mean, think about how significant this is. This one act of insane courage, of risking embarrassing bravery, and God moved powerfully. What can we learn from this story? I think a couple things. Two quick thoughts. Number one, we have to have the courage to embrace our whole story. The courage to embrace our whole story. I think so often is if we looked at our lives and the story that we tell about our lives, typically it's a polished story. It's a story that puts our best foot forward. It's a very natural human thing to do, right? But God says, you know what? I want you to embrace all of it. That's what I love about Ruth. She knew who she was. She knew she was a widow. She knew that she was poor. She knew she was a Moabite. She knew she was vulnerable, an outsider, a foreigner. All those things were true. But she didn't sort of ignore that. She embraced it and said, all that may be true, but that doesn't mean that God doesn't have an awesome plan for me. She saw herself and her life and her story through the lens of God's love. That's what we need to do. Freedom. True freedom is found when we let go of who we think we're supposed to be and embrace who we really are. God's beloved. God's child. An individual, a person, a mom and a dad with a purpose in the kingdom. But it takes courage to embrace our whole story. One of the things that we do at People of Second Chance is we platform stories. We share stories with our community that are relevant to this idea of failure and crisis and comeback and restoration and renewal. And one of the stories we shared was the story of Megan. Megan was a photographer, and she had was doing a photography business. She had a website, and her business started to decline a little bit. And so she made a very poor choice, a horrible decision, and decided to go to other photographers' websites and take their photos, copies of their photos, and bring them over to her website and claim them as her work, as a way to market her services. Not only did she take those photos, but then she would take blog posts and content that other photographers had written and put it on her website and claim it as hers. So this deceit, this deception was going on until one day she was found out. She was caught. Somebody had visited her site and said, those aren't your photos. And within minutes, because of the power of the web, because of the power of Twitter and Facebook, she was outed in front of the whole photography community. And they descended upon her with fury and rage and anger. I mean, they criticized her. They slammed her in every way that you possibly could. They attacked her looks. They attacked her, obviously, her photography. They attacked her faith. They just tore her to shreds online. Megan said, I'm so sorry. And she just kept apologizing and saying it didn't matter. So she kind of went away, said, I'm done. Well, we got connected to her later on, and we said, Megan, we want you to share your story. We want you to embrace all of it, the pain, the hurt. And we know that's scary, and we know that's going to be hard, but you see, God's not done with you. And God's not going to just leave you in shambles. He's going to be doing something restorative in your life. And so she embraced the whole story, shares it with our community. And yes, the critics did come, but also people who understood and rallied around her also came. We tell people we need to be brave with our stories so others can be brave with theirs. Have courage to embrace it all, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done, share it. I think one of the greatest forms of censorship that we practice in our lives is the censoring of our story. We'd rather be people pleasers. We sort of have this addiction to the approval of others. We want that so badly that we become these false people. We bury the very work that God is doing within us. The beauty, the uniqueness of who you are, we throw it away. And yes, we will find cynics and we will find critics, and there will be people that will tell you to cover up your wounds, and we don't want to hear about your scars, and you know, don't share that because that makes us uncomfortable. But you see, your wound is your gift that we bring to the world. There are a bunch of dream stealers out there. There's lots of people who just say, you know what, you get to fit in this box, and that's the box you need to live in. But it takes courage to say, you know what? That isn't the box I'm going to live in. I'm not going to stand on the sidelines with my story. It matters. Every piece of it matters. It's part of God's story. He's writing this powerful, powerful comeback story in your life, and he wants you to be the lead character in it. There's a guy named Monty Roberts. Maybe I shared this story before here, but I just love it, and it totally makes the point here. Monty was living... He's in high school, and he's living in a trailer with his parents and his brothers and sisters, and they were dirt poor. This basically, imagine this camper shell on the back of a truck. This is where he was growing up. His family had nothing. They're virtually homeless. And Monty's in high school, and he's going to school, and the teacher assigns a paper. And she asks the class to write an essay about what you want to be when you grow up. And so Monty knew what he wanted to be when he grows up. He wanted to train thoroughbred horses. He wanted to have a 100-acre ranch and ranch hands. And he had this beautiful dream. In spite of the fact that he's living in a camper with his family, dirt poor, he had a dream. So he writes this paper, and a couple days later, the whole class turns their papers in to the teacher. And then Monty gets his paper back a few days later. And on his paper is a big letter F. Failed. Monty's like a little confused. He's like, why get an F? He goes up to his teacher and asks him, how come you gave me an F? And she looks at him, well, Monty, I mean, the paper was grammatically correct and good punctuation and it's well written, but here's the problem. Here's why I gave you an F. Your paper is so unbelievable. I mean, this dream, this path, like how are you going to have this? How are you going to afford thoroughbred horses? And 100-acre ranch. I mean, it's so crazy. Monty, you're poor. You live in a camper with your family. But here's what I'll do, Monty. If you want, you can rewrite your paper into a little more believable dream, be a little more in alignment with what I asked in the assignment, and you can rewrite it and then turn it back in, and I will raise your grade. I love what Monty's reaction was to this critic through this dream stealer, this person that just wanted to crush him. Hands the paper to the teacher, and he says, "You keep the F. I'm going to keep my dream." And here's the deal. I love that. But that's not even the best part. That decision, that courageous decision, where he could have stepped back and said, "You know what? You're right. You're right, teacher. I am poor." He could have just kind of went away and continued to just marginalize his life, marginalize his dreams. But he didn't. He said, "I'm going to keep my dreams." And today, Monty Roberts actually owns a 100-acre ranch in Solvang, California, where he raises horses. Don't step back into safety. Step out with courage and embrace your whole story. Let Jesus move powerfully there. Finally, the last thought is that we have to have the courage to let go of our past. I think so often we let our past and our addictions and our messy divorce and our bankruptcy and that being fired from that job just be sort of the major theme of our life, to where it hinders us. It weighs us down. Ruth refused to let her past dictate her future. And so often we spend so much time thinking about our struggle, thinking about our past, trying to fix it, trying to make it better, that our whole future and the path and the journey that Jesus has laid out for us is denied. We never get there. We never look ahead because we're so busy looking back. And Jesus is saying, "I'll handle that stuff back there. I got it. That's what the cross is for. That's what Calvary's all about. You don't have to worry about that anymore." And yet we live there. I kind of describe it like we carry around these bricks, right? And just imagine this brick represents our failures and our sin and that affair and that pornography addiction. And it represents our anger and that our unforgiveness for that person that screwed us, right? It just represents all of it, and we carry it around with us. We feel safe with it. We're like, "This is my life." And you know what? You can live a pretty decent life with a brick. And you can get through your day. You can come to church and worship with the brick. Man, this brick's kind of actually heavy, honestly. I requested a brick, this is a piece of concrete, for heaven's sakes. We're worshiping. "Jesus, I love you." I mean, we got our praise on. We were sounding like Justin Bieber. And Jesus looking down, and he's like, "Dude, I love the worship. You sound awesome. But can we do something about the brick?" And we're walking around, and some of us have a lot of bricks, right? We got a backpack full of bricks. And there's a weight to it. Some of us have built like this little igloo full of these bricks, right? And we've gone inside the igloo, and we're just waiting for our lives to end and go to be with Jesus. And we're just sulking, and we're victims, and it's over. And Jesus said, "Leo, listen, I know you like the brick, but it's time to surrender the brick, to have courage to let go of all of it and to embrace what I've done in your life and the plan that I have for you. Set it down. To let it go." That's hard, isn't it? That's not easy. It takes courage. You know, I talked earlier about core, the meaning of the word courage, and that idea of the core is the heart, but also in the word courage is the word rage. And sometimes I just think we have to get so mad about our current circumstances, about how we've been living, about we've been carrying this weight. We get so angry and say, we just give up and say, God, please just do whatever you need to do. And we surrender. Think about how you're living your life. Are you living your life with control? Or are you living with clenched fists? Or are you living with open hands towards Jesus and saying, it's yours, God. Please take it. And that posture of control or an open hand and surrender. I mean, think about this. I think there's a lot of confusion sometimes about the spiritual life. Is we think Christianity is about getting something, about us being better at something or acquiring something, or, you know, if I just did this, Jesus would love me. That's not the Christian life at all. The Christian life, growing in spirituality, is about surrender, about letting go. It's not about us finding new ideas or new strategies, but it's about escaping old ones. It takes courage. We need to change. How do we change one step at a time? It's like, think about your life right now. Think about your situation, the areas of your story where you've been super safe. What do you need to surrender to God? What do you need to just place in his hands and say, God, I can't do anything about what my son is doing, but I give it to you. God, I can't do anything about my job situation right now. It's so desperate, but I give it to you. I can't do anything about this sin in my life. Jesus, I surrender it to you. That's the spiritual walk. That's the Christian walk. Close with this story. This guy named Roy Riegels, and it's 1929, and it's the Rose Bowl. And it's the crowds are cheering, and Roy Riegels is playing for the University of California Golden Bears. And the Golden Bears are playing the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets. It's the biggest game of the year. It's Rose Bowl. Amazing energy in the stadium. It's the second quarter, and Roy Riegels is the starting center for the Golden Bears, 19 years old. He hikes the ball to the quarterback. They run the play, and within the play, they fumble the ball. And within the chaos and all the people jump, all the players jump in to try to recover the ball ends up in Roy Riegel's hands. And Roy, like any good center would, begins to run. And he starts running and booking, and the crowd is roaring, and he's like, this is my finest moment. And then they ran the play on the 30-yard line, and Roy runs 69 yards the wrong way. The wrong way. He's known as Wrong Way Riegels in the history books. So he's booking. And the only reason he didn't score for the other team was that one of his own players comes out of nowhere and tackles Roy on the 1 yard line. It's a mess. His finest moment, his glory. He's like, here I go, Heisman. Oh, yeah. I mean, 69 yards the wrong direction. Halftime comes. The team goes in the locker room. Coach Price, who's the coach of the Golden Bears, gathers up the team, and he says, team, guys, we can play better than this, and we're not playing great, and we can do better. He's giving the pep talk to the team, Riegels is over off in the corner, sitting down with a towel over his head, crying. Coach Price is kind of, you know, doing what coaches do, talking about some of the plays, and then he closes with this statement. He says, listen, everybody who started the first half is going to start the second half. Now get out there, get warmed up, and let's go. Team rushes out of the locker room, and Riegels is sitting there on the floor crying, still that towel over his head. Coach Price walks over and goes, hey, Riegels, did you hear what I said? Said, everybody who started the first half, and you started the first half, you're my starter, you're going to start the second half. So get out there. And Regals looks up with tears in his eyes. He's like, Coach, I can't go back out there. I embarrassed myself. I brought shame to this team and our school, and I'm wrong way Regals. So they're going to be talking about me 70 years from now at the orchard in Aurora, Illinois. I love what Coach Price says. He says, listen, Regals, all that may be true. All that may be true. But the game is only half over. There's a whole nother half to play. So I don't know where you're at today in regards to your journey with God. And I don't know where you're at with how much courage you've been living with. And I don't know, you may have gone into that igloo full of pain and anger and bitterness and regret and disappointment. I don't know what your story looks like, but here's what I do know. The game is only half over. And today, we can start living differently. We can live with faith and courage and trust that God has a great plan for us. Life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage. And Jesus wants us to live courageous lives. Let's pray. God, we love you. We thank you that we get to be a part of your great plan of impacting the world with the gospel. Jesus, I pray for those who have stepped back, who have listened to the critics. God, remind them once again how much you love them and believe in them. God, let us get our priorities straight, that to go and to restore and redeem the world with the message of love, and not coast, not sit in our comfort zones, and not live with safety. God, show us areas of our lives that we need to surrender to you today. We want to live big lives for a big God. We're yours. Use us. We thank you for the cross. We thank you for Jesus. Thank you for forgiveness and your love. It's in your Son's name we pray, and all of God's people said, amen.